I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. More than 500 vacant buildings in Baltimore City were demolished last year, and that number could double this year. It's all part of the city's plan to reduce blight in what Mayor Catherine Pugh calls a new era of neighborhood investment. Today, my guest is Michael Braverman, Baltimore City's Commissioner of Housing and Community Development. For years, the lion's share of development has occurred in and around the Inner Harbor. What kind of development projects can transform neighborhoods across the city without displacing longtime residents and pricing out middle-income folks who work hard but still can't afford a decent place to live? Can new development be accessible and equitable? Michael Braverman joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for tuning in. This news update, this is the first day of spring. So happy spring. The Orioles play their first regular season game a week from tomorrow against the Yankees in New York. Opening day at Camden Yards is a week later on April 4th, and tonight is a full moon. Our topic today is housing in the city of Baltimore, and my guest is Michael Braverman. He's the commissioner of the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development. So any conversation about housing in our city is a conversation about two Baltimores. There's the Baltimore of downtown and the Inner Harbor with its strong history of public and private investment, and the stable majority white neighborhoods that stretch in a narrow line north from the harbor. And then there's what Morgan State University professor Lawrence Brown has dubbed Baltimore's Black Butterfly, the city's majority black neighborhoods that stretch out like two large wings on either side. Many of those neighborhoods continue to struggle with poverty, unemployment, and a lack of affordable housing on the one hand, and a huge number of vacant buildings on the other. Citywide, there are at least 17,000 abandoned buildings, and plenty of people say that's a conservative estimate. Many of those empty, dilapidated structures are in the neighborhoods of East and West Baltimore. Last week, the city pledged to tear down 2,000 of those buildings by the summer of 2020 in an effort to eliminate blight. Late last month, Mayor Catherine Pugh unveiled a new framework for community development. She's called it the start of a new era of neighborhood investment. Michael Braverman is tasked with executing those plans. Mr. Braverman has worked with the city for 30 years in both the housing department and the state's attorney's office. We'll be taking your calls a little bit later in the program. If you want to drop us an email, our number is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page as well. Michael Braverman, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here's a conversation we're going to have about development. And ladies and gentlemen, you may be hearing some sound in the background. That's because they are renovating the front of the building here at WYPR in Charles Village. Usually they knock off for lunch around this time, and we'll see if we can get them to perhaps take a break for the next hour so we don't have to listen to that the whole afternoon. But I want to start, Mike Braverman, with a little primer for folks who haven't been paying close attention. But before Mayor Pugh was elected, the Housing Authority of Baltimore City and your agency, the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development, were combined. And a guy named Paul Graziano ran both agencies. They have been split. Explain how that works and what each side of that equation concerns itself with.
Sure. Mayor Pugh is committed to community development and to investing in the neighborhoods, I think, that you just identified, have long been underserved in the city of Baltimore. And part of the way to ensure that we could do that in a way with concentrated effort was to split the Housing Authority's principal focus is on being the landlord of thousands of Baltimore City residents.
That's the public housing.
Who live in public housing, or to administer the voucher program and how to maintain those units, how to improve those units, how to integrate them better into the community. And then there's the housing community development side, which is the regulatory piece and the sort of the redevelopment authority component and the community development component. And the mayor's vision is we need those elements, we need focus on that in order to be successful in our neighborhoods.
And that's the part that you oversee.
Right. And the mayor asked me to lead the Department of Housing and Community Development, which really at the beginning is about separating the two agencies. She brought down Janet Abrahams from New York to lead our Housing Authority for Baltimore City, and we arranged the terms of an amicable divorce, although Janet got the house, so our office had to move.
Your office moved, right.
Yeah.
And there are about 10,000 public housing units in the city of Baltimore, and it ends up that division that Janet is running is the largest affordable housing agency in the city. I mean, the city owns more affordable housing units in terms of its public housing than any private developer or group of private developers.
Yeah, or if you add what Janet and her team at the Housing Authority are doing in terms of managing the Housing Choice Voucher Program, you're up at, a significant number of families in the city of Baltimore. So they're able to reach people at 30% below of AMI, which for a family of four, for your listeners, is like...
AMI is adjusted median income.
Right? Area median income. You're thinking your taxes, it's close mm-hmm. to getting close to the 15th. And so just to get a sense, you're at a family of four, 30% of AMI is roughly 28,000 in that range. So she's able to serve the Housing Authority, and that team is able to serve really folks who are what we call extremely low income. The Department of Housing and Community Development traditionally can't reach that population because of the significant amount of subsidy that it takes, which is essentially operating funds being transferred regularly from the housing and from HUD every year to support that. So I think one of the steps forward that the city has made, and this is really a testament to the advocates in the city, the leadership of the council and the mayor, is to pass an affordable housing trust fund, which provides which will lead to $20 million a year in revenue to be able to reach those at 50% and 30% below of AMI.
So let's talk about that in a second. First, mm-hmm. I want to talk about the vacants, and I want to talk about demolishing these buildings because, the 1950s, at the height of Beth Steele, post-World War II, our city had 1 million-plus residents. In the 19th century, Baltimore was a larger city than New York City. I mean, there were a lot of people here at one time. There aren't anymore. We're at 610,000, 620 last time we checked. So we got a lot of houses that nobody's living in, and there are a lot of neighborhoods where the blight is so pervasive that it's this cancer that seems to spread, from street to street and block to block. So we've heard a lot of talk, a lot of promises over the last, 4 or 5 years. We're going to tear down all these things. The governor got involved, said, I'm going to throw some state money at it. We're going to tear down all these houses. The mayor has promised to tear down a bunch of houses, but it hadn't happened. But now you're saying... That was then, this is now?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's an extraordinary concentration of blight in plaguing many of our neighborhoods, and it's very difficult to live, in that environment. It's very challenging, and the indignities are sort of endless. And the mayor and the governor are committed to providing new resources to make a difference, not just in demolition. And I think that's sometimes lost in both the mayor and the governor. It's a left and a right. It's demolition and it's rehab. And so it has happened. It's interesting, Tom, is that in reality, there, if you look at the chart I think you have in the report, hundreds and hundreds of buildings have been coming down. It's just that the trends that have led to some of those vacancies are continuing in some areas. And in some markets, they're softening, and we're seeing vacancy even in sort of middle neighborhoods. So there's a continued accrual of vacants at the same time that they're coming down, and they're being rehabbed.
It's kind of whack-a-mole. I mean, you tear one down, and then another one becomes vacant.
But in some areas of the city, and I might wander a little, and I know you're professional at holding me on point, but in some areas of the city, we've seen dramatic reductions in the number of vacants, areas that had high concentrations of vacants, where we're seeing the net numbers coming down extraordinarily in Reservoir Hill and Greenmount West and Oliver, and in Barclay, it would be good examples. But what you're referring to is that the governor's commitment and the mayor's commitment involves significant new dollars. So the $75 million that was in round one of Project Core is significant money, half of which is for rehab, half of which is for demo. And it, when you're being strategic about how you do that demolition and you're looking for whole block outcomes, it takes a little time to sort of tee it up for the excavator.
So whole block outcomes. What you'd like to do is wipe out whole blocks. And sometimes it's the case that maybe if there's 10 houses on a block, eight of them are vacant, but there are two folks who are still living there. They've been living there since 1968, and they want to stay living there. So it's legally complicated.
Yeah, but often, you know, in blight elimination demo, it's a little counterintuitive because it's not so much per se that they want to stay there. They're on a block of, say, 10 houses, only which two have occupied. One of is theirs, and the house next door might not have a roof. It's just that for not for any reason of how they've maintained that home is in pristine condition. But because of where it is, it has very little value. And so you couldn't sell and get enough money to pay the rent anywhere. You have a three-bedroom, one-bath, no mortgage. You're really stuck in that location. And so generally, it may be counterintuitive, but in these blight elimination demos, folks are looking forward to getting the relocation benefit and picking a block where they can have a three-bedroom, one-bath, no mortgage on a block of occupied houses. And sometimes it's only a few blocks away, so they have a choice. But that process does take time to do that with the sensitivity that's associated with it.
And it's not sort of cost efficient or time efficient to tear down one building at a time. It's just a better deal if there's three in a row, four in a row, you want to get all four of them down at the same time. But of course, people do own these buildings in some cases, and the city has to take ownership of them, or you know, somehow the people who own them have to release their ownership of them. I mean, there is a legal process that has to go through every place.
Yes, there is that United States Constitution, and there people do have a right to notice and an opportunity for a hearing. When we do the blight elimination demos, often we don't take title because they are long abandoned. We'll give that notice, opportunity for hearing. There'll be a default, and that gives us the authority to demo. But where the house is occupied, then there's a process of, you know, making sure that we give just compensation.
And is building a new house always the best move and always the move that you look to do first? I mean, people talk about also creating more green spaces because on a certain level, we don't need any more housing in Baltimore. And then on another level, of course, we need a lot of housing for people who can't afford housing at the moment. It's a weird dichotomy.
Well, there are a bunch of different approaches. There's not the same sort of approach everywhere. In some areas, we're looking for permanent or interim green space to sort of create a little breathing room so that the folks who are living in the neighborhood have across from them, instead of a block of vacant and abandoned buildings, they've got a green space. They can use their backyards. They no longer have, you know, as you can imagine, the kind of mischief associated with a whole bunch of vacant buildings across the street from them. There are other situations where, you know, if you think about what those blocks are like, you're thinking a row of 10 or 15 houses on one side of the street, 10 to 16 feet wide, most likely in the 12 to 14 range, and maybe 60, 80 foot deep. That is a crazy jigsaw puzzle of title. And if the future is redevelopment, we will have to use our sort of redevelopment authority and our teams. We have sort of really great competencies within the agency to do the acquisition, demolition, and then repurpose the land for new development. And you could see that happening around the city in the Park Heights RFP that's on the street right now, and in Coldstream Homestead Montebello, there's an RFP on the street right now for land. And then I could, you know, name areas around the city where that blight is being acquired, demolished, and the land assembled for redevelopment. So there's a mix of interim green space, assemblage for redevelopment, and new construction.
So you've identified 1,806 properties. I mean, you know the addresses, you know where they are, you know exactly what you want to do, and you say that you'll be able to get rid of them, to wipe them off the face of the earth by the 30th of June, 2020.
Yeah. It's not because we started yesterday. It's because this effort of the governor and the mayors has been going on so that these properties are coming out the other end of the conveyor belt. And we can give addresses, and I believe the Sun Papers has mapped them for their readers. And we are so far along the process that I feel comfortable standing here and telling you that once we get to that number, 2,000 over the combined fiscal years, FY19 and FY20, we will finally get above the rate of accrual, and we will see the total number of vacant buildings drop. And that's just on the demo side. There's redevelopment activities that are pulling vacants off the list because there's private sector investment.
But is there less of a problem with, as we talked about this whack-a-mole irony, is there less of a problem now with other houses becoming vacant? I mean, I think about the area called Carrollton Ridge in Southwest. In 2010, there were 561 vacants. Now there's 780. So that one's going up. And you mentioned some neighborhoods like Reservoir Hill, where I happen to live, and I've witnessed with my own eyes that, you know, vacants have become occupied. But that's not happening everywhere in the city. I mean, do we know that tide is beginning to shift?
Agreed. It has not happened everywhere in the city. And part of the framework for community development, which we'll talk about at some point, is about staging that those investments so that the return we can expect in some areas is neighborhood transformation. We see net declines in other areas, you know, building assets for future neighborhood transformation, where we could see investment, you know, in the near term, some places private investment in the longer term. Carrollton Ridge, even in, you know, again in Carrollton Ridge, which has, you know, some great assets, as the longest row of row houses, I think, anywhere in the United States, called the Deck of Cards. There's 52 row houses in that area. It might be in Mill Hill, forgive me. But we are seeing some investment right on Fulton Avenue, on the border with Union Square. We're seeing some investment in Carrollton Ridge on the southern border, closer to the park. There's, you know, of course, the anchor of Bon Secours. So there are some things, you know, that we are seeing positive everywhere. But I can't disagree with you that there are some places where we may be netting up in the short term. But I'm optimistic, very optimistic, about what's happening in our neighborhoods, in these areas you opened with, on the whole.
When we come back from a quick break, we will talk about this new framework for community development, which is a plan that has to do with a lot more than just tearing down houses. It's a whole very much more complicated and, as you say, optimistic and forward-looking plan. So we'll get a chance to figure out what that's all about. Michael Braverman is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development. When we come back, you are welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. We are streaming live. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, ProPublica reporter Alec McGillis will join me. He's going to talk about a provocative story that he wrote for last Sunday's New York Times magazine. It's called The Tragedy of Baltimore, in which he chronicles what's happened in our city since the death of Freddie Gray in 2015 and the violence and uprising that followed. Plus, we're going to talk to theater critic Jay Wynn Russick. She's going to have a review of Dinner with Friends at the Everyman Theater. So that's coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Michael Braverman. He's the commissioner of the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development, and we're talking about what the mayor calls a framework for community development, how to create more affordable housing, and how to alleviate the city of thousands of vacant homes that clutter and degrade our landscape. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I do want to talk about, Michael Braverman, the framework for community development, but just as an aside, did you see the piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine that Alec wrote?
Of course I did, yeah.
I mean, it paints a very bleak picture of the city, and what you and I are about to talk about is something that is a considerably more optimistic view of where we could go. But what was your reaction?
I think you've nailed it there. I'm much more optimistic about, you know, where the city is heading. I feel like, you know, we've continued to see ongoing investment. We've continued to see job creation. We have, you know, community leaders across the city very excited about this new era of neighborhood investment. We're seeing housing prices, houses sell in some of our blighted areas. You and I were talking about just a little while ago. Numbers that we haven't seen before, 260,000 in Harlem Park and, you know, $235,000-$240,000 on the 1300 block of Droodhill Avenue in Upton. We're seeing demand in areas we haven't seen demand and prices we haven't seen. And so very optimistic about where Baltimore is going right now.
Well, let's talk about this new framework for community development. What's the plan and what's new about it?
Well, one of the things we opened up with was we were mentioning that the mayor committed to splitting the Department of Housing, Community Development and the Housing Authority. So we now have a dedicated Housing Community Development Agency. And, you know, at a minimum, the mayor's vision for what that agency will accomplish needs to be articulated and transparent. So the framework is, you know, what will we be doing? How will we be taking the next steps forward? And what are our commitments to change? And so we're saying, fundamentally, where we started this conversation was there's a lack of investment in many neighborhoods around the city. And the mayor is committed to seeing investments in those neighborhoods around the city. But what that means is we need new sources of capital, right? We need to promote the investment that we want to see. We need to leverage the investment that we want to see. And so the report opens, you know, essentially identifying all these new resources that the Pew administration is bringing to the fight. And among them are these community catalyst grants, which is a way for us to build capacity in communities, because at the end of the day, this development has to minimize displacement, has to be consistent with what the community vision is of their future. And for that, we need to help our community leaders build their capacity so that we can effectively partner and share that vision.
So tell us where some of this money goes. We'll talk about where it comes from in a second. But but in terms of once you have the money, what does a community development grant mean? Who does it go to? Does it go to a builder? Does it go to people who are living there? Who's it go to?
Well, you know, it's a myriad of things, right? So, you know, one of the and again, we have had the help of the state and Project CORE for some time now, and you know, and so we've been working.
And
on
Project CORE is the state version, explain briefly what Project CORE.
Well, it's the governor's commitment to blight elimination in the city of Baltimore through a component of demolition and a component of reinvestment. And what that could mean is a grant to a community organization, and this is sort of some of the work that we're doing as well now, which is bringing significant additional resources, which is what's allowing us to do 2,000 buildings and drop below the sort of rate of accrual, get below 15,000. But for instance, in some markets, we might see investment. It might produce a rental. That may not be the way to rebuild community consistent with the community's vision of rising property values and increased demand for home ownership. And so some of that money may go from the government to a community development partner and then out into a private developer to subsidize the production of home ownership. It could be a for-profit or a nonprofit developer.
So developers traditionally, and I know almost zilch about development, so please correct me anytime I screw up, which is likely in this kind of a conversation, but developers are in it for the money. I mean, they're in it to make a profit. And sometimes, you know, if they're taking a loan from a bank, that might be subsidized by something like one of these community grants or something like that, but they've got to put together money from a whole bunch of different sources. At least some of those sources are going to require that they turn a profit. They're not throwing the money at something just because they're nice folks and they're, you know, motivated by altruism. So it's difficult to make money in neighborhoods like Sandtown, Winchester, and even in Harlem Park, and it's hard. Because it's a place that people have not been investing in heretofore. So how do you reconcile those things?
Well, I think, you know, it's important to notice we have some really good developers in Baltimore who are able to solve that problem. Yes, if you borrow money, you got to pay it back with interest. But when you put that sort of capital stack together for how you're going to you know, do the development, there may be some subsidy that you need in order to make that work. If you're looking for, say, a home ownership product, if you're looking for an affordable housing product, you're certainly going to need subsidy in that stack. So we're just so lucky that we have the kinds of creative developers who do our affordable housing, both for and nonprofit. You know, they could work for a very long time to put together the sources that they need to do that kind of development, and working with the community the whole time and working with their state, city partners to get the and private lenders. And we have both for and nonprofit single family developers. And we have CDFIs in town, sort of. We have banks, creative banking, community development financing institutions. Mm-hmm. So we have some organizations that are dedicated to getting financing out that supports community development. We have foundations that supply some of the capital in that capital stack. We have foundations that supply some of the operating in the state and the city to support the hardest dollars to get for some of these community development, community-based organizations or CDCs is the operating dollars. So
yeah, to keep a staff and to keep, you know, an
right.
office and, you know, pay the phone bill and
the
internet.
The hard
bill.
Work we just described, you know, and so part of what the framework is let's get more of that out there. The mayor set up what is called the Neighborhood Impact Investment Fund. That's one source of debt that's going to be available only in our long disinvested communities, and cheaper and more flexible and higher risk than what's out there. And that helps leverage and solve the problem that you just identified.
The report talks, and I commend it for this, about learning from the past, which is, you know, admitting mistakes had been made in the past. So what have we learned heretofore? What's new about this plan from other efforts to do exactly what you're talking about doing?
I think what's really important here is that we have a significant source of new capital to invest. I mean, it's difficult to do this work for all the reasons you just laid out without new sources of capital, right? So that's important, and that's different. It's important that we provide operating dollars, which is new sources of regular annual operating support are significant to have authentic community participation. That costs money. And I think we've learned from the past in terms of how we use the combination of sort of regulatory resources, our code enforcement tools, and our redevelopment authority tools, how we focus on whole block outcomes, and how we partner both with our community-based partners, our private sector partners, and our not-for-profit developers. Baltimore's very fortunate in that it really has, you know, a community of developers that I think, you know, integrates more seamlessly with community across the foreign and nonprofit boundaries, so that we're all focused on that mission, which is, you know, community development that creates thriving neighborhoods, because that works for everybody. Reviving the private market in housing at the end of the day is critical if we want to see demand and continued investment.
Michael Braverman is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@WIPR. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. You can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. We got a ton of calls.
Can I just add one thing, Tom? Because what we left out was also the ability to be intentional about what those outcomes are going to be, and to make sure that we've supported existing homeowners during the process, so that our legacy homeowners are present and benefiting in the future that we're all building together, and that we're building affordable housing on the front end, so that we have been intentional about keeping our community
intact. Is it a little less incremental than it was I moved here in 1982, and at that time all the rage was the dollar houses. You know, Mayor Schaefer was giving people a house for a buck, and then, yeah, you know, you had to invest X number of dollars in it and stay in it for X number of years. But I guess they found that it was one house here and one house there and one house over there. And you're talking about blocks, and, you know, yeah, is it less incremental?
No, I think, you know, one of the things you mentioned, which is correct, is that you really were borrowing at a discounted rate the cost that it would, the construction cost of that renovation you were borrowing. And so when you were done, you had a mortgage for your property, and that your construction costs were rolled into it. So the you may have bought the house for a dollar, but you had a significant investment.
You still had a loan.
Yeah, significant investment in the house. I think, we are seeing still some interest. Basically, we have a lot of vacant buildings, and the acquisition cost is really never the impediment. It's these other things that we've just been talking about, like how do you have the expertise and capital to get it done and identify, you know, your buyers. We have some great developers around town in our middle markets that are selling product, you know, that are creating demand for extraordinarily well-done renovations in neighborhoods in the Northwest that we haven't seen in a long time.
We are pinged on Facebook from Yvonne, who says this notion of middle neighborhoods. So you're not talking about low-income housing. You're not talking about high-end, you know, Guilford and Homeland and, you know, those the richer neighborhoods. But she says middle neighborhoods like Oliver Johnston Square in the East Side and certain areas of West Baltimore, we've for decades invested funding in rehabbing and new housing construction. What continues to be lacking is a community cultural and economic framework that knits communities together to keep families in place over decades and generations. We need support in helping communities help themselves. What can we do, she asks, to create more cultural and economic support systems? Is that play into your calculation here?
Yeah, I think she's right, of course. I mean, you and I have been spending some time talking about sort of the built environment, but, you know, there's the investment in, you know, our existing residents, the amenities that a neighborhood needs to have to be successful, the job opportunities and entrepreneurial support and the commercial corridors, and these are all components of a thriving community that. And again, I think it's worth mentioning that in the framework, not only is the mayor bringing new resources and not only is there a commitment doing this in an equitable way, minimizing displacement and ensuring that our legacy residents benefit, but there's also a neighborhood sub-cabinet that's been created to coordinate these efforts across the agency. So many of the things that the caller has spoken to are things that, you know, collectively as a city, the mayor has different leaders and different agencies who play a role in helping to ensure that that occurs. And she's bringing them all together in a neighborhood sub-cabinet to ensure that community development going forward, and this, again, speaks to your question, what are we doing differently? This neighborhood sub-cabinet is very different in terms of delivering across agencies sort of the mayor's vision of comprehensive community development.
I've got a number of calls here, Mr. Braverman, so let's take as many as we can. Let's go to Steve first in Seton Hill. Steve, welcome to Midday Michael Braverman.
First of all, I'd like to say I love preserving old architecture and historic neighborhoods, but I'd like to ask your guests how much too strict enforcement of historic preservation rules might, first of all, add to abandoned housing, and second of all, prevent investment. First of all, a lot of these standards, if they're strictly enforced, people with low income simply cannot afford to meet them. And I know there are loans and so forth, but you have to be able to repay the loan. And what I've seen happen is that a person, usually elderly, they'd like to dress up their home a little bit, preserve it, make it look a little better, but they can't afford to meet the standards, so they let it go. Eventually they die, their kids either don't have the money or aren't interested, the house is left, taxes are not paid, there you go, another abandoned property. Another thing that I've seen happen, people want to invest, buy a house that is, you know, in terrible shape, but is beautiful at one time and has potential, but they look at the standards and they're just too tough, and they're just too expensive. I mean, a window, a historic standard size window to get installed is about $1,200. And if you're on a corner property and you got 10 windows, that's $10,000.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for that call, Steve. So when it comes to historic preservation, there are certain neighborhoods that are designated as historic in nature, and to retain the historic vibe of the place, there's a thing called CHAP, the Citizens Housing
Commission
on Historic and Architectural Preservation, right? And they require, you know, pretty specific things about how you fix up your house. You can't just go slap drywall on a wall that, you know, necessarily didn't start as a drywall wall, for example, or if Steve mentions the windows. How does that play into the calculation?
Well, I think the caller identified some of the many issues that are associated with historic designation, but largely the fact that a building is in a National Register historic district or in a local historic district means that there's going to be significant tax benefits to support the renovation. So on this, you know, there's another side to the discussion, and that is that some buildings, it's the tax credits that are important. You want enough of the building standing to make you eligible to get the tax credits that will help you do the renovation. Now, in National Register districts, you're not, if you live there yourself, you're not obligated to meet the standards unless you're looking for some kind of benefit from MHD and the Maryland Historic Trust in the city. And so I would say that, that you know, generally speaking, yes, he's right that some of those costs, you know, are high, but as on the whole, the tax credits work to sort of favor renovation.
Michael Braverman is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development. We got to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll get to some more calls and emails. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page, and you can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. We're talking about housing today. By the way, tomorrow afternoon, the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Service and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. That's not Michael Braverman's organization. That's the State Department of Housing and Community Development. They're giving a clinic that explains the importance of estate planning and the very important need to make sure that your name is on the deed to your property if you are a homeowner. So that's evidently not the case all the time. So some volunteer lawyers are helping folks make sure that they can correct any problems. The clinic, I understand, is fully subscribed, but you can get more information at a website called myhomemydeed.org. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Michael Braverman. He's the commissioner of Baltimore City's Department of Housing and Community Development. We've got a lot of callers waiting. We've got a lot of emails. We'll try to get to as many folks as possible. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. We have a email from Kim in Kim Lane, who's the interim executive director of Pigtown Main Street. And she brings up the importance of supporting work along the corridors that are being developed. She says, first of all, kudos on a comprehensive and refreshing plan, but commercial corridors such as the Washington Boulevard Monument Street with local businesses are essential for a thriving neighborhood. Does the framework envision supporting work along these corridors? Will there be a gateway program, and does the plan address property owners who own vacant and nuisance commercial properties?
Yes, I would say, again, Baltimore is so fortunate to have so many people working in so many communities across the city to make this a better place to live. And in the framework, we identify this neighborhood subcabinet we're talking about and how that subcabinet functions with seven work groups, one of which is the commercial corridor work group. And the idea there is to do really what Kim is talking about. How do we get the agencies together? Because successful community development, as she identifies, requires that we have thriving commercial corridors, right? And we need to leverage that activity. And how do we use all the different city agencies? So the mayor's commitment is across agencies to deliver on this plan. This may be the Department of Community Development putting it out, but the subcabinet is the mayor's recognition that she needs sort of an all-hands-on-deck approach, which includes commercial corridors.
Let's talk about the racial equity and accessibility dimension of this, which is very important. This is a city that has a long history of redlining and a long history of barriers to people of color when it comes to home ownership and to affordable housing. We have a couple of emails about it. But what are the ways that the equity and accessibility can be addressed under this plan?
Well, you know, first and foremost, you know, that's the history of our country nationally, not just in Baltimore. You know, it's a history of we have systemic racism, and that has sort of led to much of what we see today, that's woven into the fabric of the present. What we're really talking about is how do we ensure that doesn't define us in the future? And what are we going to do differently to make sure that we have brought all of our efforts around that understanding? And again, part of the plan here is what are we doing? How are we doing it? Who are we doing it with? And what's our vision of success? And so the plan envisions a shared community vision of the future and working collectively to achieve it. So we're working with our community leaders in our long disinvested neighborhoods to promote the vision that they want to see, bringing the resources that they need to execute that mission, and making sure that we can protect that all Baltimoreans benefit, that those legacy homeowners are supported so they can be there, that there's significant new resources to promote affordable housing, mixed income affordable housing, mixed income communities, and that requires some heavy lifting.
Yeah, we have an email from Betty who makes a point that we've talked about a lot on this show, not today, but we have for years we've talked about. When you look at the white working class neighborhoods, historic neighborhoods in Baltimore, Canton, Hamden, Remington, Locust Point, those have undergone a significant amount of development in the last 10 years, 15 years. But the black neighborhoods, Harlem Park, Sandtown, Park Heights, they have been neglected. Does this plan... and they've been neglected for a variety of reasons, but certainly, you know, just institutional racism is high among those reasons. Mm-hmm. Does this plan specifically target places that have been historically ignored?
Absolutely. And that's really fundamentally what's different here today. What this plan does is highlights, dedicates, and directs investment to long disinvested communities by creating new investment vehicles that are only eligible in those areas, but by committing to transformational change in four areas around the city. On the west side, in Upton, in Druid Heights, in Penn North, on the east side, in Johnson Square, in Broadway East, in Coldstream Homestead Montebello, and in East Baltimore Midway, in the Park Heights communities, and in the seven communities of the Southwest Partnership. So we're talking about a commitment to leveraging significant investment for transformational change in the short term and for achieving the vision that those communities have for their future.
Michael is calling. Welcome to Midday. Michael, I guess you're involved with the charter school in Harlem Park. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thanks. Yes, I was one of the founder parents of the charter school. And so my question is this, could a panelists speak about the, how charter schools or how schools are an important part of the community? Because it seems like our school, though small, had a good impact on the community and was like a community center, yet it's being closed as some other schools are that serve African-American communities. So it just seems to me like the schools are very important to the community, and maybe, you know, the whole city can get together about, you know, why a school could be important to be kept open just for the entire community is if it's doing a satisfactory job. Why can't we make extra effort? I think our school had to pay a substantial rent to the city, and it put it behind. And so I'm just asking for, okay, you know, more consideration for
school. Thanks for the call, Michael. I appreciate it. Again, when you talk about this sub-cabinet, is school and education and proximity to a good school in these communities something that plays into your
plan? I think that's what defines, you know, a thriving community is access, you know, to good schools. And I think the caller makes, you know, a really important point, and thankfully so, because we hadn't talked about it yet, but that the intersection of schools and community development is, you know, among the more critical intersections. And we're fortunate that we have had a program of investment in schools in Baltimore City, the 21st Century Schools Program, which is investing more than $1 billion in schools in communities around the city of Baltimore. And, you know, how we leverage that to to promote community development in that proximity is things that some foundations are focusing on, but that we will be focusing on more going forward.
Yeah, but there's easily could be tensions in any individual instance, right? Here's the school in Harlan Park that Michael is talking about. The school system, for whatever reason, has decided it's in their best interest to close that school and concentrate on other places, and you don't really have any control over that, really?
No. I mean, this is very difficult decisions that the school board is called upon to make, you know, but I think that, you know, they're looking at the bigger picture of how to serve the children as we are as well.
Christina sends us an email and says, the community development approach that Mr. Braverman is describing is wholly market-based. Why should this market approach succeed this time if the reasons that the neighborhoods are in the shape they're in the first place is because of market failure?
Well, that's a good question, you know, because the reality is, you know, we've seen these massive macroeconomic changes in the economy. You started by talking about the economy of Baltimore and the sort of the post-World War II economy, and so much has changed, and that's market-related. But I think one of the things we're saying is we do live in a market economy, so that's a given. But there are things that we can do to leverage that market, and of course, I agree with the caller if the sense was it would be great if we got those resources from the federal government that allowed us to intervene, you know, on a much more significant level. But we have the resources that we have, and we have a net increase based on this new era of neighborhood investment that the mayor is promoting. And we have to use those resources strategically to leverage investment. And I think that we started by having that discussion about how those resources could leverage a private developer that a community has picked to renovate a home for home ownership and to raise housing values to the point where the market begins to function. So yes, there are extraordinary challenges. And I think we mentioned there are historical inequities and structural inequities built into our economy. Locally, we're doing what we can, and the Affordable Housing Trust Fund is an example of, you know, adding a local tax, you know, arguably something that we should be seeing from the federal government in order to support the activities that the caller indicates.
So where does that money come from the Affordable Housing?
Yes, that comes from transactions at greater than $1 million as a recordation and transfer tax on documents. And that is estimated to generate itself around $13 million a year.
So if you're developing a very expensive, you know, million-plus project, it's going to cost you more than it used to.
Yes, it is.
Does that you know, attenuate people's the attractiveness of Baltimore to do business?
Oh, I can tell you the development community isn't happy about it, but they, I believe, to date, they have been managing that the reality that this new tax is coming into effect, and it's going to allow us to leverage investment in neighborhoods where the market has really unfortunately been unable to serve folks who can't compete in the market for housing when you're at 30% and below of AMI or 50% and below. You can't compete in the housing. You need that subsidy. And that's one of the great things that the mayor, the council, and the advocates have given us in this new era of neighborhood investment.
We are running out of time, but I want to sneak Dan in. Dan calls from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday. Dan, we have time for a really quick question. What's on your mind?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I'm originally from New York, and I know that the words rent control have not been mentioned on your show. I know that rent control is something that will help because the rents are going through the roof in Baltimore, and working class people are suffering, and it's just something that will stabilize the market. But I don't know why it's never being brought up. It works very effectively in New York.
Thanks for the idea. What do you think?
I think the caller's issue about rents is probably one that I would probably need to look into a little more. I know that Baltimore is a kind of city where, in different parts of the city, the rents aren't, put it this way. Let me agree with the caller and say literally 50% probably 50,000 households are cost burdened when it comes to housing. So what the solution is to get there, right now we're talking about subsidies to create more affordable housing at 50% and below of AMI. And we have other sources and new sources to get at 80% of AMI.
And we're going to have to leave it there, but we will have you back and we will continue to talk about this very important issue. So thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Michael Braverman, he's the commissioner of the Department of Housing and Community Development in Baltimore City. And we've got a link to the new framework for community development on our website, wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's all the news that's fit to print. A very unflattering portrait of Baltimore City appeared in the New York Times last week. We'll talk to the guy who wrote the article, Alec McGillis. He's from Baltimore, by the way. And we'll also talk to theater critic Jay Wynn Russick, who'll have a review of a show at the Everyman Theater. We want to thank Dangerously Delicious Pies for lunch today. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. We've got more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Stay tuned for Future City with Wes Moore. That's coming up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your tuning in. Have a great day.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.